welcome to another edition of IFN Podcasts. My name is Lauren McCautry, and today I'm speaking to Khalid Howladar, the managing director and founder of boutique Islamic advisory firm Accreditus. Khalid is an expert observer and long-standing thought leader in the field of Islamic finance, with 15 years at Moody's under his belt, culminating in his most recent position as global head of Islamic finance and head of GCC banks. Last year, he left to launch his own proposition in the form of Accreditus, a brand new risk, ratings, regulatory and Islamic finance advisory practice. And today he's going to talk to us about the effects of the Trump presidency and the UK Brexit vote and why they represent a manifestation of problems to which Islamic finance could be the answer. So Khalid, thank you so much for being here with us today. Just as a bit of background to start us off, perhaps could you tell us a little bit about what led you to start to launch this new startup in the form of Accreditus? Why did you decide to take that risk at this time?
Sure. Thanks, Lauren, for the introduction. Well, basically, I'm based here in Dubai in the Middle East, and as we know, it's quite a tumultuous time in the region, mostly brought on by the onset of lower oil prices in 2014. And the market has traditionally been much more of an equity type market. But in recent years, debt, Sukuk, you know, these have really come into the fore as regional governments look to sort of buffer up their finances by issuing more and more debt and Sukuk securities. So we've had record years in Sukuk. And in that environment, because it's still an emerging market, I found there were lots of market participants who were interested in these markets but weren't quite sure how to go about or how to start, particularly in the Sukuk market, which is quite new. And from my previous role, I knew a lot of these sort of corporates, banks and sovereigns from my past life. And it seemed like it was the right opportunity to try to strike out on my own with, you know, with a couple of partners, try to set up some advisory to help the stakeholders in this market to get started. And then the other side of the coin is obviously the Islamic finance angle, where it's still a relatively new and immature market. There's still a lot of developments going on. There's still a lot of learning that's happening. And again, in that space, you know, bringing my knowledge and the knowledge of my partners to sort of help clients really get to grips with this topic and participate in what is a very fast growing sector that has, frankly, some emotional appeal, religious appeal to a lot of the participants in this region.
And I think that information and research and sort of insight aspect is really interesting. And I know that one of the first things that you did with Accreditus was to do some studying, to write a paper looking at the Trump Brexit paradigm, the Trump Brexit political kind of impact. So why is that area so important for the Islamic finance industry? What kind of issues does it throw up?
Well, the thing that brought me to sort of write this paper, I mean, when I was at Moody's, I was strictly writing about, you know, the credit and the risk and the ratings side of things, which can be a bit dry. But Islamic finance goes far, far beyond just, you know, the ratings and the debt space. And as a British citizen, as somebody who was born and raised in the UK and proud to be a British Muslim, I was quite upset by Brexit, because the values that I support are diversity, inclusion, you know, all these great things about the United Kingdom. And when this happened, I was like, well, what actually drove this vote? And then later on in the same year, you had Trump also being elected. And these were both sort of major sort of populist upsets. And in some ways, you can say it's democracy in action and so on. But I was sort of looking into the cause of these events. And I think from my perspective, you know, one of the biggest key social drivers was the rising amount of inequality in society, and how, you know, the 99%, you know, the rich are getting richer and poor are getting poorer, et cetera, et cetera. And what's really interesting is Islamic finance is actually a very, I think, old form of inclusive capitalism. You know, people support capitalism, Western countries, and capitalism is great. You know, everybody does well, but that hasn't been the case. And the reason, my opinion is really around the obsession with debt finance. And if you look at the state of the world today, got out of the last debt crisis by taking on even more debt. So I think globally we have $165 trillion in debt. 225% of GDP, global GDP. How is this ever going to get paid back? It's probably not the case. Now, Islamic finance, as I'm sure your listeners will be aware of, actually discourages or prohibits interest-based income, debt-based income. And it's interesting, sort of having come at it from a more sort of economic and financial standpoint, what is wrong with debt? What is wrong with interest? Well, in a society where richer people tend to own assets, they tend to have property, they tend to have land, they tend to have equity. And when you have a lot of debt, you borrow that debt cheaply and you leverage your equity. And guess what? Those people who own assets, which are already sort of the wealthier parts of the population, get richer. Those people who tend to have a lot of cash and receive sort of low interest income tend to be lower income people that have money in banks. So what happens is that, you know, again, to simplify, rich people tend to use the money that's in the banks from poor people to then leverage their wealth. Meanwhile, poor, lower income people don't get a share. So Islamic finance favors equity type ownership, asset type ownership. So if you want to borrow my money, if you want to use my money, invest it in a business, invest it in something tangible, and give me a share of what you get back. And so this sort of economic angle is really, I think, missing from a lot of the sort of holistic discussion around what is Islamic finance, what is the value? Is it just there to replicate everything that we already have, Islamic credit cards, loans, bonds, loans, et cetera, or is there a different angle to it that makes it better suited for society? And so that's why I figured I needed to tie those ideas into a paper. And unless we can address the rising inequality in society by encouraging people to invest their money more into assets and discouraging the use of debt, the global system is getting more and more fragile and income inequality is getting wider. And I just don't see that as a socially sustainable solution for the future.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting, and what you say is very compelling, especially the argument about financial inclusion and the benefits of Islamic finance. But in reality, is that really the case? I mean, if the vast majority of the headlines that we hear about Islamic finance are about Sukuk, for example, which is easily probably one of the most well-known instruments, and surely that is debt. A lot of the Islamic finance, a lot of the Islamic funds coming into the UK, for example, are coming from very wealthy people from the Middle East and Asia who already have those assets, who are those rich people getting richer that you just mentioned. So, do you think that Islamic finance is going through a bit of an identity crisis? I mean, it might have the power to solve those problems, but is it really doing so in its current form?
I think you've really hit upon the crux of the issue. I think the way to sort of caveat that, firstly, it is relatively young in terms of awareness. So the fact that people, investors, stakeholders are talking about Islamic finance makes people curious. But you're right, the poster child of Sukuk markets isn't really a good sort of flag bearer for the values of Islamic finance. I mean, Sukuk instruments at their core should be asset-backed type of risk-sharing, profit-sharing type of instruments. But crucially, the two most important people in the market are issuers, are investors, and issuers and investors want the equivalent of a bond or debt type instrument. And that's just the way things are. But I still see that as a good foundation that, look, we've got awareness around Islamic finance. There is a market that's developing. We can't go straight from A to Z day one. Maybe from on the sort of alphabet scale, maybe we're only at letter D or E or F or something like that, and we've got a long way to go. But now with that foundation, which frankly, as you say, replicates a lot of the market and probably doesn't add a huge amount of value, there's a lot more soul searching about, as you say, what indeed is the identity of Islamic finance and the social values, the environment, all these things that are actually now buzzwords, ESG, environmental, social governance, socially responsible investing. All of these elements are actually meant to be part of the DNA of Islamic finance. So from that foundation, which, as you say, probably doesn't do much to support those broader, noble social goals, perhaps now there's a platform where those institutions can now start to differentiate, develop and devote more resources to the social element of that. And so that's kind of what I'm hoping, and that's kind of what I try through education to say that, look, I do a lot of actually pro bono work with universities, and I try to get in front of young people to say that, look, this is where Islamic finance is today. This is the sort of genuine value proposition for what it holds for the future. It's a bit of an effort to get from A to Z, but nonetheless, as long as you're aware of the differences, then you can act as an agent for change. But what is an issue in the market at the moment, as mentioned right at the outset, human capital levels, development, training, learning is still relatively weak. It's so complex, it's easy to lose people. You know, myself as a financier with 20 years experience in both risk and looking at structured products, it took me a while to get my head around this kind of concepts, what was actually happening. So if you're the average, you know, customer on the street, you'd have no hope, really, in trying to understand the core sort of value proposition. You're relying upon these sort of media messages about what Islamic finance is meant to be, but then you can't really make the connection between what it's meant to be and what's actually happening, which is a car loan or a mortgage, or in all but name. So still a long way to go, you know, as you say. But I do think from the platform of where it is, more identity is developing, and with more education and transparency, then those that genuinely care and see the value proposition can start to move things, you know, slowly in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And what, I mean, you know, we hear this kind of thing a lot about, you know, the need for more awareness, the need for more education, you know, the need for a higher quality of human capital and talent. You know, and these are all sort of, you know, sort of themes that have been reiterated, you know, for the past, you know, however many years, particularly, you know, IFN events, we hear them, you know, on a regular basis. What do you think, as a practitioner and with your longstanding industry experience, in the context of this changing global financial environment, and as you say, this rise of, if not necessarily inequality, certainly, you know, pushback against perceived inequality, which maybe has resulted in some political outcomes that are a little bit concerning for some people, what concrete steps do you think the Islamic finance industry needs to take? How can we change in a material way to improve the situation?
Well, I think there's an issue there in that a lot of the industry has a vested interest in the current system. So there's in all these sorts of discussions, you need to look at the various stakeholders around the table, whether it's regulators, whether it's the population, whether it's bankers, scholars, you know, lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole industry of people who are practicing in this market. And you have to look at the agendas and the motivations of those individuals. Now, the Islamic principles favor more equity-type finance and more profit-sharing-type instruments, and that's quite a different market. And so until there's a customer need and drive, you know, these agents are all acting, you know, part and parcel for that market. Where change comes from, and I think this is where, you know, countries like, you know, Malaysia are a good example, where from the top down there's a sort of a public policy drive, and they are the ones sort of getting all the actors together and saying, look, this is what we want and this is where we're trying to go. You know, Dubai is supposedly the center of the, or setting itself up to be the center of the Islamic economy and so on, and there's a lot of work in terms of fostering education development. But this sort of identity of Islamic finance, I think, needs to come from the top down, and that social element needs to be a material driver, because the market operates with market forces. It's supply and demand, it's price, it's risk, it's return. You know, those are the things that are more concerning for the participants in the market. The social element is only now starting to feed through, and not just in Islamic. Globally, there's much more attention to the environment, social and governance. And there are some studies that say, actually, ESG is not just a nice thing to do and a morally thing right to do. It actually generates better returns, companies are better run. So there's still that sort of mindset developing that social concerns and elements are actually good for business. But for the time being, there's a, you know, an industry out there that works. And if you really want to sort of push that more social agenda, that more inclusive agenda for society, I think you can't just leave it to the market per se. That's where, you know, governments, you know, regulators, policy makers genuinely have a role in saying, okay, this is what we want in our country. What can we do to support it? Islamic finance is a pillar of that. Let's support or at least give more attention and awareness to the social elements. If parties want to set up more sort of inclusive type financing mechanisms using Sharia. So interestingly, actually at the last IFN conference I was at in KL, I met a fantastic chap who is using Sharia compliant blockchain technology to raise finance for microfinance institutions in Indonesia. And that for me is the most like amazing sort of application of Sharia compliant finance and technology and really getting into that space where, you know, because there's such low incomes, you know, the industry by and large neglects or ignores those. So there are actors out there, but it's still a bit sort of cutting edge. And but for that type of technology and that type of inclusive financing to get support, it needs attention, more awareness, and to say, look, this is kind of where we want to go. It's very small. It's just starting, but let's support it and let's do everything we can to try and get people in that direction rather than just loading them up with credit cards and mortgages and car loans until they, you know, until they break. Because right now, interest rates, profit rates are super low. You know, there's been all that quantitative easing from the governments. So we are at a real risk that as rates start rising, a lot of people who have taken on debt, you know, in recent years may once again find themselves struggling. And that's just not good for corporates, not good for society as a large. So we need to be mindful that this perpetual debt cycle that we're in is going to end probably badly at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm. I think I hear what you're saying about disruption, and I think you're very right. We are gradually seeing more of this in the industry and that technology side of things. We're seeing Sharia compliance, crowdfunding, financial inclusion, you know, cryptocurrencies, blockchain coming out and having an impact. We're seeing green funds and green sukuk, and I think all of that's very relevant. I guess a question would be, you know, perhaps circling back to your earlier point about the 99%, you know, versus the 1% and financial inclusion, we tend to see a polarization of Islamic finance, where we, you know, at the one end you've got the, as you mentioned, the big issuers, the big investors, the institutional funds, you know, the massive sukuk issuances that you know no one but the banks and the, you know, the funds can invest in, and then at the other end we've got guys like you referred to, I believe you're referring to Matthew Martin of Blossom Finance in Indonesia, who does this, you know, very you know, wonderful, you know, financial inclusion for really the sort of bottom end, you know, the people who wouldn't otherwise get access through these microfinance instruments. Is there an argument to say that there is a gap in the middle where the average person who isn't a millionaire, isn't a high net worth individual, but nor is, you know, a sort of Indonesian rural farm worker with no bank account, is not getting access to that or even being made aware of what Islamic investments or financial instruments could apply to him? We don't see a lot of retail sukuk funds, for example. Is that an area, you know, where maybe there's you know, a bit of underserving that could be changed?
Yeah, I would agree with that, because and once again, like, Malaysia's maybe the you know, the leader in that regard, because that middle income segment that you talk about, you know, puts their money in banks and they want to see it the next day and the day after, and they're typically sort of risk averse with those savings. But in a lot of banks, you know, they're labeled as profit sharing accounts when in reality they're not the case, and even the regulator would not allow them to, you know, have sort of profit and loss sharing on accounts that customers perceive as being safe. And so in Malaysia, I think it was a couple of years ago with the Financial Services Act, where recognizing that there was a bit of confusion, customer confusion in that middle segment, that are these profit sharing accounts? Are they not profit sharing accounts? And so a new segment of accounts were created where there is a bit more profit and loss sharing. And there's a big red sticker that says, customer, beware. This is more profit and risk sharing. You might lose some of your money here. So there needs to be, I think, in that middle segment, firstly, the instruments and the accounts available for them to express either view, go for safety or go for a bit more return and a bit more risk. But around that, just to sort of educate that middle income population that as long as you're not looking short term and that you are saving for the long term and the midterm, etc., by and large, owning equities, owning assets actually pays you much more return in the long run and is much better for your net wealth as a family or as an individual than by just purely keeping money in cash. And the money in cash, even in banks, I mean, if you look at the banks in Cyprus, those people that had money saved up in the banks in Cyprus, cash, they lost. Banks are not necessarily foolproof. I mean, I used to be, head of the banking team here in the Gulf. And, there's perception that banks are super safe and keeping your money in cash is super safe. But actually, even banks can go under. And so there's always an element of risk, but people forget that. But with more education of that middle income segment to say, look, if you look over, let's say, a 5, 10, maybe even a 15-year horizon, everybody who has invested at least some of their wealth in assets, in property, in land, in equities, which are much more sort of Sharia compliant, there's a bit more volatility along the way, which you have to be prepared for. But as long as you sort of have a long-term view of one part of your personal middle income wealth, by and large, you benefit much more as a society. All these economic gains of globalization, AI, technology, who is deriving all these gains? It's going to the corporates. There's a reason why you have Facebook, Apple, Netflix, can't remember, Google, the FANG stocks. These companies are leveraging all the benefits of growth and capitalism, but it's not being distributed. Now, if everybody in those, let's say, middle income segment had 10% of their wealth invested in technology stocks or something, and that they held on to that for 10 years, equity investing is very Sharia compliant, they would have benefited from these global trends and these technology trends. But when you hold your money in cash because you don't know and you're not aware and you're risk averse, you're missing out on the economic gains of the world that are accruing to all of these other more educated and savvy people. And that's just a shame. So that's where governments, education, education, we get taught maths, English, physics, chemistry. Finance is so crucial for the way that we live as individuals. And it's the biggest destructor of low-income families and so on. It's crazy that you don't get taught the basics of finance, within school. It's much more of an impact on your life, on your daily life, than physics or chemistry. So I really think education, top-down drivers to push this more inclusive agendas and educate people that, look, it's all of your wealth or savings in cash. It's great, but in the long term, you're missing out.
Mm-hmm. And now I think, just to circle back to the start of the discussion, we started off talking about Brexit and the Trump administration and, how that sort of highlights or manifests, endemic issues within, perhaps our global financial system and social system. Circling back to that now, what do you think, obviously these represent, a groundswell of feeling, whether or not it's held by all parties. Do you think that this is going to have an impact on Islamic finance? So, you've been discussing the need for governments to take a top-down approach and support Islamic finance, take the UK. Do you think that things are going to change after Brexit? We're expecting that to come up in 2019. What do you think are going to be the consequences? Is Islamic finance going to have a rockier road?
Sure. I mean, firstly, just to sort of be very clear, in terms of top-down, the top-down needs to be focused on this inclusive social development element and not just, you know, let's have the biggest Sukuk market or, you know, let's have lots of international investors, you know, participate in our Sukuk market, etc. So, you know, top-down is great, but if it's just there to serve, you know, the capital markets, it's not going to, you know, trickle down to these elements that we need. In terms of Brexit in particular, I think it could be a positive in that the UK needs to now be, assuming it goes ahead, it needs to be much more outward looking. It needs to focus also a lot more on the well-being of its population that have voted, you know, symptomatic with their concerns. So given that, for me, I feel, you know, Brexit, a lot of it was about, you know, economic disempowerment and, you know, perception of reducing wealth and loss of jobs, etc. Having some of these ideas come into the, you know, the DNA of call it UK capitalism, where, okay, there's a segment of the population that feels disenfranchised. How can we get them more on board and more involved in the economy? Well, you don't necessarily have to call it Islamic finance for all the reasons. I mean, I am a fan of the Turkish term of participation finance, because in one word, you encapsulate almost the entirety of the sort of value proposition for those. So bringing in more, the UK might be more open to bringing in some of these more participation finance type of concepts into the economy. And then in terms of, you know, in engaging with other countries, it needs to be focused now much more outwardly on parties outside the EU in terms of trade, in terms of cross-border finance, in terms of FDI and investment and all these good things. And if these ideas are important to pools of capital in the Middle East, in Asia, and these are fast-growing pools of capital, you know, when it's the, you know, Employees Provident Fund of Malaysia, the state pension fund, which I think now is around 180 billion or 200 billion in assets. When they say 5% of our investments need to be Sharia compliant, well, then anybody that's looking for investment funds, which is the UK post-Brexit, more so post-Brexit, okay, so by doing things in an Islamic way or by doing things in a more sort of participatory way, if we can attract these alternative pools of Sharia-compliant liquidity that are dotted in the Middle East, that are dotted in Indonesia, Malaysia, et cetera, then that's also beneficial for the UK as well in terms of tapping those other Sharia-compliant funding pools. And it's something the UK needs to think much more about post-Brexit.
Fantastic. Well, Khaled, we've come to the end of the podcast. Just one final question before I let you go. 2018, we're almost halfway through. We're in May already. I don't know where the year's gone. So for the final half of the year, what are your top tips? What are your trends that you think are going to be ones to watch for?
Oh, okay. That's a very tough one, actually. I mean, I'm based in the Gulf, and so looking at oil prices, looking at the Venezuelan situation, the Iran situation, it looks like you know, you might see even more of a bump in the oil price, and that's the tide that kind of lifts all boats. So the region has been under stress previously. You've now had a bit of a almost like a rank ordering of the region, with sort of countries like, you know, UAE, Abu Dhabi, you know, Kuwait at the top. And then you have the really pressured systems, more pressured systems, you know, towards the bottom of sort of Oman and Bahrain. And so I think they might get a bit of a reprieve. There needs to be this ongoing restructuring in the region. So I think that will create opportunities in terms of Islamic finance. I mean, Oman has gone from zero about 5 years ago of Islamic banking assets to, I think, around 11 or 12% in that space of time. Same, I think it surpassed Turkey, which has had Islamic finance for a long time. So I think necessity is the mother of invention, and the low oil prices have stimulated a lot here. So I think you will carry on seeing Sukuk issuance from the region, less so than before. But because rates are low and there's a window, relatively low, then I think there's still an opportunity to keep tapping. I do think you'll be see much more emphasis on social development, inclusiveness. You know, at the event in Asia, you had a number of prominent bank CEOs talking about values-based intermediation, and so applying more values-based financing in their decisions. So I think that's the millennials, the next generation of customers, are much more sensitive to this type of thinking and do want to see an element of social inclusion, I think, in what they do. And then the last thing I'd probably highlight is really, again, the confluence of technology and Islamic finance, where a lot of these sort of practices, like you highlight, like crowdfunding, etc., were just impossible before. The logistics involved in doing crowdfunding were just too complex. And now that you can actually use technology to make that easier, I think smaller projects, as you mentioned, Matt of Blossom, I think the next project they're looking at is like a hospital and so on. So I think technology is enabling much more of these small ticket projects that are too expensive, so too low value for the big players to look at, opening up a space in the sort of micro, the SME, the small, where there should be hopefully much more activity going forward.
Wonderful. Well, Khalid, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I think we've had a really wide-ranging and insightful conversation here today. I'm sure our listeners will appreciate it. So Khalid Howlidar of Accreditus, thank you very much. I've been Lauren McCautry, and this has been another edition of IFN Podcasts.